Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Good evening and welcome to Views of the News, the show that this week is going to scramble to keep up with news-related events and to try to provide you with some perspective on them. I'm your substitute host, Lee Wilkins, and with me in the Reynolds Journalism Institute studio are faculty colleagues, Professors Linda Kraxberger and Charles Davis, who are smart, thoughtful, and quick. In a bit of a change from the usual, I'm going to begin the program by telling you the news-related topics we won't be touching on this week. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's retreat to the Ecuadorian embassy in Great Britain in what appears to be an effort to dodge deportation to Sweden on rape and sexual abuse charges. Media coverage, some would call it speculation, about the impending Supreme Court ruling on the case that focuses on the Affordable Care Act, the signature health policy initiative of the Obama administration. What appears to be the likely departure of NBC Today Show host Ann Curry in a network response to a ratings dip in the Today Show morning programming juggernaut. We'll have time in the coming weeks to visit all of these topics in more depth. And I will mention only here the death of Nora Ephron, who began her career as a journalist to become one of the most successful and one of few women screenwriters in Hollywood. Now that they've cleared the decks in a bit, we'll begin this week with a discussion of a New York Times piece about the death of Washington Post foreign correspondent and Pulitzer Prize winner Anthony Shadid earlier this year. In the Times piece, Shadid's brother says that Shadid felt compelled to take ever more dangerous assignments, in part by his employer, to the point where he put himself at grave risk. With correspondents making serious efforts to find a way to report from inside Syria, and with journalists dying in ever larger numbers as collateral damage in Mexico's drug wars, it seems important to talk about the risks that journalists take and what their employers can legitimately ask of them. Then we'll move to a piece that seems related, at least to me. It's the Atlantic article by Princeton professor Anne Marie Slaughter, former head of the policy wing of the State Department, on why women still can't have it all. The piece itself has engendered a lot of media response, including a front-page story in the Sunday New York Times that disputed much of which Slaughter said, and plus discussions of many sorts on NPR and a number of commercial news outlets, several of which are posted on our blog. We're going to focus on why a story like this gets so much media attention and whether this sort of coverage actually promotes discussion of what is obviously, at least from my point of view, an important issue. Next, we're going to ask Charles to talk about a Supreme Court ruling that's received very little coverage, the court's decision to strike down a Montana statute that challenged some of the central assertions in the Citizens United case. Since super PACs and campaigns appear to be spending significant time this summer gathering ever larger campaign war chests, we'll talk a bit about the meaning of this decision for the upcoming election, which promises to be the most moneyed in U.S. history. And then we will get to the truly big media story of the past 24 hours, what appears to be Rupert Murdoch's decision to break up his media empire into two separate companies, one devoted to news and books, and a second, far more lucrative one, devoted to entertainment programming. This corporate decision apparently won't be made until tomorrow, but we'll talk about the potential reason for and the impact of this noteworthy shift. We have a very full plate, but I want to begin with some discussion of the piece about Anthony Shadid that appeared in the New York Times. I met Shadid once and was at the University of Wisconsin this spring and able to attend a celebration of his life by both faculty and students at Wisconsin, his alma mater. Shadid got his journalistic start at the Wisconsin Badger Herald, and no matter where he was on the planet, he had time for email relationships with current staff members. In that memorial, more than one person, including his editor at the Washington Post, remarked that Shadid had told them more than once that the conditions in the Middle East, and particularly the Arab Spring was the story that he was born to report. Since I had all of this background, I was taken aback by the Times story. So let's begin with a larger question it raises. Linda, what sorts of risks can a news organization ask even the most qualified and gifted journalist to take to inform the rest of us?
Well, I think news organizations ask reporters to take some minimal risks all the time. Anytime you are out there, I always joke about the mean streets of Columbia, but anytime you're out there reporting on situations that could become violent or could become deadly, there's a certain amount of risk involved in that. And I think in I think this story sort of points to another question, which is how likely is it that the Times asks someone to risk their own life versus how likely is it that the reporter volunteered? And I think in war correspondent cases, it's far more likely that the reporter themselves takes more risks than editors ask them to take. And so I'm kind of interested to see how much more this case may or may not unfold. Some of the early comments on this case have been, if this was a routine practice at the New York Times, you would hear much more anonymous commentary about how other people were fearful about their lives. I think there was a situation in which on any given night, somebody can be particularly furious at an editor. They can say, you know, and they make statements that if I die, it's on their head. And I think that's the situation that the cousin was referring to in the Shadid case.
Well, and Charles, I mean, one of the things that sort of this reminded me of is I keep hearing reports from journalists who have actually made it inside Syria. And I sort of go, oh my goodness, is the next thing I read about you that you're going to be dead? Because that's no person's land. I don't think you're safe from either side there. I mean, at what point do we say it's too much for you to risk?
Yeah, and it's easy, I think, to sort of dismiss Shadid's brother without realizing that, you know, this is his brother. And so he's reacting to this pretty emotionally. If he were to actually have seen probably the dynamic of a war correspondent in the Middle East covering the story that, as he said, he was born to cover for, if anybody was pushing the envelope, it was probably the war correspondent. So I think most of us with any knowledge of the industry and how it works know that war correspondents are famous, incredibly famous, for pushing the envelope with regard to their personal safety and not the other way around. I mean, I just don't know of any news organization that goes, we want you to take more risks. We mm-hmm. want to push it. Mm-hmm. I can see how from the outside perspective it might look that way to his brother. But realistically, I don't think that's the case. Now, I mean, and this is coming from, you know, a guy, the most dangerous thing I ever covered was probably a NASCAR race. I mean, I didn't do any of this danger seeking. But I have friends who fall in the foreign correspondent, war correspondent camp, and they are different cats. They operate in a different mindset. I'll commend a book, Chris Hedges' War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, in which he talks about in really disturbing ways, in a way, the fatalism of the war correspondent and how they court danger. And it's disturbing. I mean, as he admits in his book, it is disturbing.
Well, I think one of the things that most interests me about the coverage of especially the Mexican drug cartel wars in California area, I mean, every place that's involved in those, is that the journalists involved are thinking very much simultaneously, how do I keep myself safe? Actually, I think that comes second. But how do I keep my sources
correct,
safe so that they don't get offed essentially for talking to a journalist?
Correct.
And I'm not sure how much the average person, the average newspaper reader or television watcher really understands sort of that negotiation process that occurs before the news ever actually gets published or broadcast.
Well, I was going to add to that, not just the negotiation between human being to human being, but the negotiation within my own head, within my own soul. So I don't have that kind of negotiation with myself. But I've just watched this sort of internal battle and internal struggle. How far can I push it? How far can I go? How much can I say? How can I report this situation in a way that doesn't reveal this source or doesn't reveal the track that I took to get here so my tracks can't be followed?
The other thing to note is the distant war zone is one of the last provinces of what used to be commonplace, and that is cutthroat intra-party competition for news, right? I mean, if you go back to your Kodachrome 1940s, 50s movies where reporters were pushing each other out of the way to get stories, that still happens among war correspondents. They are intensely competitive because there's a restricted space in which news can be gathered, and you know the other people who are there to gather it against you. And it's very much this sort of old-timey notion of competition that in most of the domestic American news media space is gone.
Well, and that dance of where are you going tomorrow, where are you going to be tomorrow, and not quite revealing where that's going to be.
Yeah. And in some cases, that's a competitive thing. And in other cases, that's there are people I need to protect. Mm-hmm. Well, as journalists, we do try to have it all in a lot of ways. But Anne-Marie Slaughter's piece in The Atlantic, I think, struck a chord with many of us. In fact, Linda, when I sent you a note about this, I got a one-word response: can't. But before we get into some of the guts of what she said, I want to ask you why you think this particular magazine piece has had such a profound agenda-setting effect on other news organizations.
Well, I think this subject routinely sparks the same kind of fire that it sparked in men and women and women and other women since the 1970s. There's this just mommy wars mentality, and it is just a fiery piece of stuff. I won't even just say journalism. It's a fiery subject. And so anytime some new thought leader comes out with something on it, it's going to create sparks, and it's going to create that agenda setting effect. This one in particular, I just think you have somebody saying some provocative notions about ways that the workplace could be changed to make not just women's careers more efficient. I don't know, powerful, but parents in general, and I think that is part of the. Conversation.
So Charles, in the Sunday New York Times on page one, there's this pretty lengthy piece which basically takes issue with what Slaughter wrote in a number of ways. What sort of news decisions do you think went into reporting that story, where it was placed? You know, why did the Times do that?
I found that story bizarre on many levels. First of all, you take a story that's gotten as much buzz, as much traffic as that story's gotten, it would seem to be an endorsement of the story in and of its very self. And so you use that as an avenue to rebut the major points that she was making. I don't know. It was almost like they were treating that article as if it was a piece of science instead of a expository essay by a writer full of personal emotion. And I'm not exactly sure how you come off faulting the writer for that in any way that looks less jerky than the Times story did.
Well, I was going to say, I found the Times story, in a lot of ways, it just was sort of out of left field. I'm going because in the original Atlantic story, she says, I'm writing for people like me, people who are elite, people who have choices. Mm-hmm. I acknowledge that most women and most people are not elite. They don't have these kind of choices. Yet there comes the New York Times saying, oh, she's running this elitist stuff, mm-hmm. like they hadn't read the piece in the first place.
Oh, you know, the New York Times always looking out for the proletariat. I mean,
well, like the Atlantic isn't, like, we wouldn't know by definition in its publication in the Atlantic that it's for an elitist audience. Come on.
Right, right. Yeah. And I thought the power of that story lay in the fact that it was so full of emotional revelation on her part. I mean, she really exposed herself emotionally in the writing, and that's what made it so – I mean, for me, the Mail, it was riveting reading because it sort of almost crosses genders because there's not a parent. There's not a parent on exactly. the earth that hasn't faced a moment where they felt less – than adequate because of the demands of the workplace, regardless of what the workplace is.
Right.
And also, whether she was elitist or, you know, the graveyard shift at a manufacturing plant, those problems are the same, regardless of social status. Yes, you have more tools to solve them, maybe, if you're a Princeton professor, but they don't make you feel any better.
Well, even in her elitist point of view, in the academy, I remember once famously Lee Wilkins telling me when I was about to have a child that you now are going to recognize some of the benefits of being in higher education. And one is that my work schedule was a little bit more flexible than it would have been had I been in some kind of professional position. On the other hand, it's not as flexible as it could be or it might or some people say it should be by default. And that's I think, the point that you were making with me earlier, that what is our default position in many of these cases of parents and family and workplace behaviors?
Yeah. Well, one of the things as I was reading the article, because it, you know, it's women, so I'm looking for my own life in it, and then I backed up a little bit and said, I think the headline on this in some ways was misleading. It was why women can't have it all, but more truly, it was why committed parents can't have it all.
Sure.
And because there were a lot of lessons in there that I said, well, of course, because the one parent is doing this so that the other parent can do that, and you take it the next week and it'll flip. I mean, my husband and I used to refer to it as the tag team wrestling match.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go away and you do your thing and you run back in the ring and you tag the other person so they can go out.
And when you have toddlers, that's a good metaphor too.
Oh, toddlers and teenagers works both ways. So, but I mean, I was just kind of stunned at the New York Times. I thought you guys didn't read this or didn't read it carefully. I don't know. You're right, Charles.
Whenever the New York Times tries to go populist, it's just painful for all involved. I mean, it really is. And that was another class. They do it all the time. And it's almost like it's an overreaction to the fact that probably in the travel. Well, no, I'll guarantee in the travel section of that same newspaper was a vacation that cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $25,000 to go on.
Yeah. Well, okay, Charles, since you started on that, the Supreme Court's getting a lot of media attention this week. I think it's likely to get a lot more. But last week, there was what I thought was a pretty significant decision that, at least from my point of view, flew under the radar. So before we get to talking about its impact, can you kind of brief us on, quote, the Montana decision?
Yeah, sure. The Montana case is significant in that it was, if you heard nails being driven into a coffin, those were the last nails being driven into the coffin of a judicial solution to campaign finance reform. It was an upholding of the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case of 2010. And if you were to hit rewind on all of that, you would go back to Montana, which has had some peculiarly difficult issues with regard to corruption in politics and landed interest and mineral interest controlling elections there. They have a unique history when it comes to corrupt politics. And a lot of it had to do with people buying and selling elections. And so Montana, in the wake of Citizens United, a challenge to its own state law came up. And that state law ran afoul of the Citizens United striking down of caps on contributions and the Citizens United regime. And what the court has said, in essence, in this case was, see, Citizens United invalidated, right? So it was a repudiation of the idea that the court would revisit Citizens United in the wake of all the criticism that it's gotten, not only for the practical effect of Citizens United and the unbounded money that you see going into super PACs in this electoral season, but the legal logic behind Citizens United, which a lot of people that aren't sort of reading the legal scholarship don't know. Citizens United has been subject to a withering assault in the legal scholarship just for its reasoning. So it was interesting. Those of us who watched the court closely, I think, probably knew it was coming. But it was still kind of a death knell sort of a case. So now the ball's back in the legislative court, if anything's to be done about campaign finance.
Well, meanwhile, I think the ball is also back in the journalist court. And one of the things that I've been listening to somewhat gleefully is the NPR series, which essentially goes out and reports on who the people are and what they believe and tries to get them to go on the air if you've given $1 million to somebody's political campaign.
Okay.
And one of the things that I find hilarious from a journalistic perspective is that most of these people don't want to talk to journalists. They didn't think that their $1 million campaign contributions were going to be reported on, that they themselves are going to become noteworthy and the subject of media attention. They just thought it was like kind of all quiet and under the table. So Linda, with that kind of preface, what I want to lob at you is, so what are the kinds of campaign finance stories that you think in the run-up to November we should be either looking for or demanding from news organizations?
Well, I think it's the same as any election, that we want a full and fair accounting of who's giving money to what cause. I don't necessarily think, even though we want to know, And for instance, one of those full and fair accountings is what kind of out-of-state money is coming in-state to influence your – what you might consider to be a local election for you, or even somebody who's going to Congress or somebody who's going to the Senate, you consider it to be a matter of interest to people in your state. And yet – lots of out-of-state money is coming in for that particular cause. I think that's of interest to people in the state. I think the other thing that should be of interest to people is what kind of money is going to the ads that we see on TV. So not all – a bulk of campaign finance money is going to the advertising issues. But the titles never represent the true interests and what the real beliefs are going on behind the scenes. I also think once you find out that information, it really isn't going to change who you're going to vote for or why. It just gives you a clearer picture.
And I think we've all had stories like the poor NPR reporters that are doing this series. These stories are just so painful to do because they quickly become a story about a person who won't talk to you. Right?
Right.
And those are so difficult. So then you end up talking to other people at non-government organizations or think tanks or political analysts who talk to you about why the person isn't talking to you. And that's what those NPR stories have become. They're good and I enjoy them, but they've got to be so difficult for the reporter. The other thing that I hope journalists start paying very close attention to is that in the wake of Citizens United, actually before Citizens United, and certainly in the wake of it, proponents of unlimited campaign spending said, oh, it's not a big deal because we're going to be completely transparent about the money and where it goes and how it's spent. Those very same people, I'm talking to you, Mitch McConnell, are now saying very publicly that donors should have secrecy. And they're arguing about donor privacy. And if you mix unlimited campaign finance donations with donor secrecy, you have a disaster. In my opinion, I mean, the only antidote to unlimited money is scrutiny and accountability for the donation. And if these people can essentially control elections and then hide behind anonymity, that's astonishing.
I'm trying to figure out what the argument for anonymity would even be.
Other people will ask me for donations.
I'm a private citizen. Therefore, I get to remain private even though I'm giving to something that is essentially a public cause.
Right. And, you know, there was a Proposition 8 case out of California about this very issue. Petitioners who signed the petition in favor of restricting gay rights in California petitioned the court to make their names secret because groups that were opposed to them filed public records requests for their names. And none other than Justice Scalia wrote the majority opinion in that case and said, put on your britches and this is big boy work. And if you're going to engage in political issues, you're going to engage publicly. Thank goodness for that opinion, which was only a couple of years ago.
And did he use the words precedent. Big boy britches?
No. Those are mine. But he did say something about like grow up. This is adult business, this politics.
Okay.
And if you're going to come out on the courthouse square and throw punches at people, you're going to do so publicly. And that's wonderful language.
Well, I'll recommend one more story that I didn't get a chance to put on the blog. The Washington Post over the weekend ran a story about how much money, I believe it was about 100 senators and representatives had made on stock sales of firms who had been appearing before their various House and Senate committees for various kinds of regulation. That one is well worth reading, or at least I found it so. And it's also one of those things that I keep saying, okay, the Washington Post did all this hard work for you, other states. Why is not the local newspaper now going to its representative and say, okay, explain to us how come it is that you got to get rich or at least more well-to-do off of this kind of trade while the rest of us are legally prohibited from doing exactly what you've done.
Yeah, particularly when you talk about the extraction industries, coal, fracking, pipelines, and you look at the politics of the people who are so indebted to those causes, it really paints it in stark relief.
Well, The three of us plus host Mike McKean have spent an awful lot of time the past many months discussing Rupert Murdoch and the phone hacking scandal in Great Britain. I think the only consistent conclusion we've come to is that we are not going to be surprised by anything that happens. But news in the last 24 hours that Murdoch was going to subdivide his media empire actually did not come as a great shock. Charles, to me, this move is all about money and staunching corporate bleeding. What do you think is the motivation behind this particular decision and what may or may not come after it?
Well, I think all of this is emanating from London and the soap opera we followed these many months. This, however, is a decision that may be as much about controlling the stock price for the broadcast side of the ledger as anything else. I mean, he's trying to staunch the bleeding from the wound that is the print division right now, not just fiscally, but legally, risk-wise. And I would imagine he's being advised by a whole lot of smart financial people that this is the move to make. It may also – this is my crackpot theory. I get it from nowhere other than my own brain.
It may
allow
part.
Him – I know. It may allow him an on-ramp for his son James to begin to regain some semblance of an executive's life again after being effectively deposed from the broader – Murdoch Empire.
Lyndon, in recent media history, when corporations carve themselves up, they are frequently planning to sell one or more of the parts. What do you think would be the impact on journalism if Murdoch ultimately divested himself of that part of the empire that is newspapers and books? Do you think that would matter at all?
I think it would matter on sort of moral grounds. I think it would matter in a sort of yay for us kind of way, that I think that many people would just be heartened. Sometimes you don't want to have the new leader that you don't know versus the tyrant that you do know. That phrase comes to mind.
Meet the new boss the same as the old boss?
Right. But I think in this case that there is so much that is – so many people denigrate about Rupert Murdoch's tabloid industry and the phone hacking, but just the deeper sort of Murdoch philosophy. And I think that would be cheered. I can't think of an aggregate word, you know, I don't know anybody who wouldn't cheer that on the journalism side. And I think from a moral support kind of way, that no matter who were to buy the pieces of Murdoch's journalism side, that people would be happy and it would cheer newsrooms.
Charles, what do you think? Murdoch, if he ultimately does wind up divesting, which is I think what he's actually going to have to do, is that going to matter?
Oh, it would matter a great deal. I mean, I think there'd be deep sighs at the Wall Street Journal, to say the least. And whoever the new boss was, he'd be better than the old boss. And I think they'd be quite happy. It ultimately remains to be seen if, you know, he's going to sell or if he's just going to have a split list with two different stocks there. I get the feeling he wants to get out of the print business, even though – when you look at it emotionally, print's been his baby his whole life. I mean, he's an old newspaper guy, and he's really fond of that vehicle.
Yeah, I heard an analysis, I think it was on NPR this morning, where someone was saying, well, the newspaper, the print business is like an ice cube. And I'm going, an ice cube? Maybe it was because it was quite warm. And then they said, slowly melting away. And I thought, oh, okay, I get the metaphor. And this might be a good time for Murdoch to get out, in part because I don't think all the rocks have been turned over in the investigations in London. But that's maybe me being either cynical or wildly optimistic, depending on your point of view.
Well, and despite the whole Daily Beast and the notion that he was going to rock the world, that hasn't happened for him either.
Yeah. Well, we've run out of time, but certainly not out of breaking news. And we'll be taking next Wednesday off to celebrate July 4th. So on July 11th, Mike McKean will return to hosting duties. I'll be at a conference in Colorado about, of all things, disasters. So I'll return with some up-to-the-minute insights into the wildfires raging through the West and how the media are covering this crucial environmental and climate-related problem. Meanwhile, I need to once again thank our production crew, technical director Travis McMillan, and audio wizard Pat Akers, and of course my colleagues, Linda Kraxberger and Charles Davis. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank you for listening and sharing your opinions about these important stories with us on our blog at kbia.org. Meanwhile, try not to melt. Have a wonderful, if warm, evening. This is Lee Wilkins for Views of the News.